The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words. And this program comes to you from the Commonwealth Institute. And those taking part are Dennis Powell, Anne Scott James, Dennis Norton, and Frank Muir. Round one to test their vocabulary. 2 marks if they get the meanings of these words more or less right. Dennis Powell, to begin with. What is oxyopia? O-X-Y-O-P-I-A. Oxyopia.
What means sharp-eyed?
Absolutely right. Can't fault you there. It is, in fact, the noun. It means abnormally keen vision, but it isn't the adjective. That's all right. Dennis Norton, what is a mammy? M-A-M-M-E. Mammy.
It's a boy's best friend.
Something to do with sucking, it must be.
Why must?
Or could mamma mean the breast?
Yes.
That which is sucked, I should think. No go.
Well, yes, there is a connection here, I think, with... come on away from the animal kingdom, if you will. Try vegetables for change.
Well, it's a vegetable that looks like your mother.
I don't think so. And I don't think you're going to get it. It is a tropical American tree with large, yellow, pulped fruit. And I don't think it looks like anybody's mother. Anne Scott James, the meaning of miscreant, M-I-S-C-R-E-A-N-T, miscreant.
Oh, fie upon you, you miscreant. It means a wrongdoer.
Mm-hmm. Miscreant, vile wretch or villain, but originally, and as an adjective, it meant heretical and thence depraved, and it comes from a French word meaning somebody who was a misbeliever. He was a chap who was naughty because he didn't believe the right things. Frank Muir, what is a malmaison? M-A-L-M-A-I-S-O-N. Malmaison.
Malmaison.
Yes.
It's a house. at the end of the Mall. It's Buckingham Palace.
They're not so far wrong at that.
It's where one of Napoleon's girls lived.
It's where we think it's where one of Napoleon's girls live.
Give me the girl or woman, and I'll give you 1 mark out of 2.
Well, Josephine.
Yes, that's good enough. 1 out of 2 for that. Malmaison was a palace of the Empress Josephine, who married Napoleon first, but from the house came a particular kind of carnation. So Malmaison now is a particular species of carnation. Well, now, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down. And I want the 2 women members of the team to go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the program, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. Dennis Powell and Frank Muir, your quotation is, "They also serve who only stand and wait." And Anne Scott James with Dennis, here's yours. "Do not cross your bridge till you come to it." And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their ideas of how these came to be said or written. Round 2 is about legends and myths. 2 marks for a correct answer. Tell us, Paul, what was the name of the character who rode the bodies of the dead across the river Styx? And what was his fee for this service? And where was it kept, the fee?
It was Charon.
Yes.
What was the next bit?
And how much was he paid for the...
How much he paid?
Single. It's not a return.
Oh, he was paid an obol.
Yes. And do you remember where it was kept?
Oh, no. That's too much.
It's all a nice touch.
Is it?
And where did Charon...
In his pocket.
...pick it from?
Oh, he took it from the tongue.
Yes, that's what I wanted. Charon, an old man in a black sailor's cloak, kept the ferry across the river Styx, leading to Hades, and when you laid out your dearest and best, you put this little coin, the obol, under their tongues so it wouldn't fall out. And then when they went to the sticks, Charon took it out of their mouths because that was, as you say, the single fare into Hades. 2 months. Next, Dennis Norden. The Sphinx at Thebes put the following riddle to every passerby, and if they couldn't answer it, they were killed by the Sphinx who threw them over a cliff. What goes on 4 feet in the morning, on 2 feet at noon, and on 3 feet in the evening? And who answered this particular riddle correctly, and what was the answer?
Which way is the cliff? Not any windows cleaned or anything like that. wait a minute. This is a... Oh. It's man. I don't know why, but
yes?
I remember the answer to it was man.
In the evening, he goes with a stick.
Yes?
Three legs.
Oh, that's it, yeah.
When he's grown up, he goes on two legs, and when he's a baby, we've answered it the wrong way around.
That's right.
Well, it's more difficult to answer. Anybody can answer it the right way around. We're answering questions backwards.
That's splendid. It's the backwards but quite correct answer to the riddle. And who did the correct answer? Do you remember?
Anne Scott James. I remember distinctly.
Well, provided she didn't have to kill her father and marry her mother.
I don't care, as long as we get the mark.
I'll help you.
Oedipus.
Thank you.
Rex.
No. Yes, Oedipus Rex. Well, not Rex at this stage, but later. Now, Anne Scott James. Who was Ancaeus? A-N-C-A-E-U-S.
Was he Jason's pilot?
Yes, that you're getting there.
Come on, get nearer.
Yeah, that's it. You're getting there.
He was social director.
Oh, yes. PRO, that's what he was. Jason's PRO on the Argo.
Well, I'll give you the proverb and see if you can invent a story to fit it. There's many a slip between cup and lip.
Does Medea come into this?
Later on.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Sorry.
I think I'm going to give up.
Ancaeus was the helmsman, or the second helmsman, of the Argo. And when he was planting a vineyard, a soothsayer told him that he would never live to drink the wine from his own grapes. And so immediately the grapes ripened, Ancaeus squeezed them, some of the juice, very quickly into his cup, was just about to drink it triumphantly, when the soothsayer, who happened to be there alongside, said, "There's many a slip between cup and lip." And just then somebody came running up to say there was a wild boar which was devastating the countryside, and rashly Ancaeus put down his cup and rushed off to kill the boar, and the boar killed him. Frank Muir. One of the labors of Hercules was to steal a lady's girdle. Who was the lady?
Madame Lolo.
Nice thought.
Aphrodite, I don't know.
I think you're getting it.
Aphrodite.
No, she had a girdle, but that's
she had a girdle. She did, yes. Really?
Oh, dear, I'm helping you.
It wasn't Antiope, it wasn't...
No, to do with horses.
Hippolyta.
All right. I don't know what to mark you this. I don't think more than half. The hero Hercules, or Heracles, had 12 labours, which he was made to do by King Eurystheus, and one of them was to steal the girdle of the queen of the Amazons, Hippolyte. She was ready to give it up of her own accord, but Hera, the goddess, was being very tough as usual and started a sort of local squabble going on. In the battle, Heracles killed Hippolyte and got the girdle. We now have a round about origins and derivations. 3 marks for defining the present meaning, first of all, and then giving the origin and derivation of these words or expressions. Dillis Powell, go to the devil.
I beg your pardon?
The phrase is, go to the devil.
Go to the devil.
Present meaning and origin.
Well, the present meaning is, I mustn't be too rude in my translations. I really don't care about you. You'll be off and we won't bother about you. Go to the devil. Well, it sounds like a kind of religious...
It isn't, you know.
Isn't it?
Mm.
No.
Yep. If I'd said go to the mermaid.
Oh. Mermaid. It was the name of a tavern.
Yes.
It was the name of a tavern.
You know where it was?
It was in London.
Well, I've helped you quite a lot there. 1.5, I think. If anybody goes to the devil, the obvious meaning is that they go to ruin, go to hell. In the 17th century, one of the best known of all pubs in the city, near Temple Bar, was the Devil Tavern, and it had a lovely sign with the devil pulling St. Dunstan's nose. And Ben Jonson and other writers of the day used to go there very often and use this phrase, he's gone to the devil, meaning this particular inn. It comes again and again in Elizabethan literature. So I think this probably is the origin. Dennis Norden, a guinea pig director.
He's one of these chaps who sit on boards of directors because they've got a title or something.
Yes. Yes.
Well, that's what it is, the chap who sits on a board of directors because he's got a title.
And why guinea pig?
Well, presumably because you can make him do as you like. Or you're using him simply for... No. I don't really know, Jack.
I think you've got the main thing. It's director of a company who was there really mainly for ornamental reasons, who didn't do much except attend meetings, and allow his name, usually a rather prominent name, to appear on the company's notepaper. He was called, I think, a guinea pig director because it was the usual procedure to pay him a guinea or so and to give him a lunch every time he deigned to turn up to a board meeting. Tuma. Anscott James. Pumps. P-U-M-P-S.
Well, they mean slippers.
Yes. What kind of slippers?
They've low heels, usually, or no heels, and they're apt to have bows on the toes.
Mm-hmm.
Men's evening shoes are called pumps.
Yes.
Okay, that far?
Yeah, absolutely right so far, yes.
Does it come from the pump room at bath?
Yes,
the bath attendants slopped around the bath, as in pumps.
Why would they do that?
Well,
so not to
keep
their
kicking
feet
them off easily, yeah. You know. Yes, they could kick them off lightly and slip them on again.
2.5. Pumps are very light, thin-soled, dancing or shoes, or soft-soled, canvas-topped gym or tennis shoes. They were used for either. But Queen Victoria went to Bath with Prince Albert. He was very pleased.
Was she amused?
On this occasion, very amused indeed, because she found that the waiters in the pump room glided round the room so extraordinarily silently, and she wondered why. And she saw they were wearing these sneakers or pumps or very noiseless shoes, so that they didn't upset the people who were taking the waters there. And this is where the rest of the story comes in. She insisted that all the waiters and stewards on the royal yacht should all be supplied with pump room shoes or pumps. And this is how they came to be called pumps for the first time. Frank Muir, he's a bit hipped, or badly hipped.
It's, means annoyed, isn't it? It's sort of a let down.
Let down more.
Yes.
Yes. Annoyed.
He's badly hipped. He's been, he's come out disadvantageously from something.
Yes. And comes from?
Well, it comes from sort of Middle English period, when it was believed scientifically that if you weren't happy, sorrow went to your hips. And you grew sort of fat and flabby around the middle. So to get hipped.
1.5. He's a bit hipped means he's depressed, low-spirited, melancholy. And it is a corruption of the first syllable of hypochondria. From that, people said he's got the hip. And also, and more vulgarly, he's got the pip. But it originally came from hypochondria. Now a round of, which is roughly the who, why, and what department. Again, 3 marks, correct answer. Dennis Powell, what were the 4 freedoms and who defined them?
4 freedoms? Speech, want, hunger, worship.
You've said worship, you've said want, you've said speech. I want one more.
Movement.
No,
travel.
No. All right.
It's Roosevelt.
We'll stick at that. Who said this?
Roosevelt.
Roosevelt, yes. 2.5. The 4 freedoms were defined by Franklin Roosevelt during World War II, that one of the aims of all the democratic nations was that when the war was won, all peoples on the earth should live in freedom from fear, from want, and have freedom of speech and freedom of worship. 2.5. Dennis Norden, What was the forces slang expression for PM, and what was the accurate term?
Pip Emma.
Yes.
Post-meridian.
Yes, that's all right. That's what I wanted. 3 marks. Anne Scott-James, who was the patron saint of archers, pinmakers, and soldiers, and why?
Archers was St. Walter Gabriel.
St. Toxophilus.
I don't know, really, the patron saint
Sebastian,
of pinmakers.
What happened to him?
When he was shot with a rain of arrows. He was martyred.
And why was he the patron saint of soldiers as well?
Well, I should think he was a martyr. Well, I imagine because archery was the chief means of fighting in those times.
2 out of 3, I think. It is Saint Sebastian. He was martyred by being bound to a tree and shot at with a large number of arrows, and they stuck out of his body in lots of these paintings, rather like a mass of pins on a pincushion. Hence, he was also the saint of pinmakers. He was also a centurion, that is, himself an officer, and therefore on the side of soldiers, and was patron saint of soldiers.
What makes you think the officers are on the side of soldiers?
A very generalized
you
sense.
Never served in the ranks. No.
I agreed, Dennis. Frank Noah, still soldiers, who led his regiment from behind? He found it less exciting.
The Duke of Plaza Toro. In the gondoliers.
Yes.
By Gilbert and Mr. Sullivan, who's a musical gentleman.
Absolutely right. And now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier on the program. 2 marks, Lewis Powell. Can you give me the origin of your quotation? They also serve who only stand and wait.
It's the last line of Milton's Sonnet on His Blindness.
Absolutely right. John Milton, Sonnet on His Blindness, ending thousands at his bidding speed, and post or land and ocean without rest, they also serve who only stand and wait. Anne Scott-James, the origin of your quotation, which was, do not cross your bridge till you come to it.
It's a proverbial expression.
Yes. That's probably enough.
Full stop.
Yes, that'll do, I think.
Anon.
It is originally an old proverb. It's quoted later by Longfellow in a poem of his called The School of Salerno. Don't cross the bridge till you come to it is a proverb old and of excellent wit. And now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever unlikely explanation receives the longer amount of applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Frank Muir with his quotation, they also serve who only stand and wait.
I heard something on the wireless last night that made me go all audible. It was on the newsreel, and this lady who's president of the Hygienic Society or something, Mrs. Mary Adams, she said that in the interest of hygiene, all domestic pets should be destroyed. Oh, I came over all peculiar. When I think of me and my Hannibal, I'd be lost without Hannibal because, you know, I just live in this digs in Notting Hill Gate and me and Hannibal, he's company, you know, we play and we have fun together. You can't beat a budgerigar, you know. But I always remember when I first got Hannibal, I brought the cage home and I hung him up in my room. And it was awful, you know. He was lackluster. He just stood there in his little cage, all blue he was, a lovely blue with a yellow beak, just sort of leaning with one shoulder against the bars. He wasn't interested in anything. He didn't play with his little swing, or didn't jump on his bar and play with his mirror. Nothing. Didn't he eat? I didn't know what to do. Then I thought, you know, he's a young budgie, Hannibal. He hasn't got a mummy. He doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know how to play or eat or anything. I'll have to teach him. So, of course, I put him out on the windowsill, and I painted bars on the window so to make it look to him as though he's looking inside a cage. It was quite easy, really. I screwed the trapeze into the ceiling, and I swung on it for quite a while. It was really quite pleasant, you know. It was a bit awkward when the landlady came in, you know, explaining why my face was blue, you know, my yellow nose, and... But I swung away, and Hannibal started to take an interest, you know. But, oh, it was sweet. He wasn't eating, though. Would not eat. Not a bit. There was his bird seed in his little china bowl. Ignored it. Didn't know. He got thinner. Oh, it's always feathers started coming. I glued them back, you know. It's best. Losing weight. Oh, I was so worried. And I watched other budgies, and I saw what they did was they tramped round in their seed first and got sort of friendly with it. So I got the seed merchant to send up half a hundredweight of wheat, and I poured these 5 sacks it was of wheat all over the carpet, and I took my boots off, and I walked up and down in this wheat just to show him. Oh, it was all terrible. It was terribly painful. And every evening, I gritted my teeth and I stamped around on the wheat just to show him, how to do it. And I said, "Look, Hannibal, this is your food." Oh, my feet were, they were raw, like slices of bone, and all itchy. I couldn't go to, it's awful, it was. But after about the third week, he suddenly, little Hannibal, got the message, and I saw him walking around with his own little feet all over his own bird seed, and he started to peck it. And now he's a beautiful budgie. Lovely, big and strong, and lovely feathers. Do you know, the other day, I was reading in a paper all about a policeman telling us how he trained all the Alsatians and what a terrible job it was, and the way the Alsatians tore him to bits and leapt on him and pulled great chunks out of his arms as he trained them how to catch burglars. And I thought to myself, it's all very well, Mr. Police Dog Trainer, you've suffered, but you don't know what I suffered to get my Hannibal well. I said, you may suffer pain in your job, but they also suffer who only stand in wheat.
Well, now we go back to Dennis Norden, and if you remember, his quotation was, "Do not cross your bridge till you come to it."
I would like to remedy a fault in a recent Home Office pamphlet giving householders tips on how to deal with au pair girls of every nationality, Austrian, French, Swiss, Portuguese, German. However, they did not put out any tips on how to deal with the nationality of au pair girl which we last had. She was an Eskimo. But she was a very nice girl. She turned up that evening, swathed in animal skin, carrying what I thought at first was a rather oversized tennis bag. Turned out to be a kayak. And she was smothered in, from head to foot, in blubber fat. My first tip, therefore, is if you have an Eskimo au pair girl, don't let her stand too near the electric fire. They break out in a sort of batter. One thing I would remind you is on the question of time off. Now, you must be very careful about this and very prudent. On no account must you say to them, "You may have the night off tonight." You see, where they come from, a night is 6 months. So it can be, as with us, that you say to them, "Have a nice evening, dear," in March, and next see them in September, by which time there is quite a pile of washing up. However, when they do go out, do show them round the neighbourhood and make sure they are acquainted with it. Ours left and came back and said she'd spent 3 hours in one of the little huts that we put up in case of blizzards. I followed her next time, saw her crouched in this telephone box. Now, my last tip, their sleeping arrangements. Now, you must remember the sort of climate to which they are accustomed. We wondered why her bed never looked slept in. And I never really found out the reason till that night I came down at midnight for a snack. Opened the fridge. Of course, it depends what you have in the fridge, if you do have blancmange's setting, rice pudding and so on. So my last tip is, if you do have an Eskimo au pair girl, defrost the fridge all day and only use it when you are about to eat. Or, as the old proverb has it, do not frost your fridge until you come to eat.
I think there'll be a run on Eskimo au pair girls after that. And by your vote, Dennis Norden wins the contest of the two stories. And as far as the contest as a whole is concerned, he and Anne Scott James win by 5 marks from Frank Muir and Dulles Powell. And that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC. ¶¶